Now, Nancy Hanks brings broad experience and deep understanding of all the facets of the artistic and cultural life of the nation to her current assignment as chairman, or I suppose it should be chairwoman, of the National Council of the Arts and the independent agency of the federal government created in 1965 to encourage and assist the arts, the nation's cultural resources, called the National Endowment for the Arts. An exciting and challenging career began with service in the Office of the Defense Mobilization and the President's Advisory Committee on Government Organization. That career moved on and up to the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare and the Special Projects Office of the White House in the Eisenhower administration. Then for more than a dozen years before taking the chair at the National Endowment for the Arts, Miss Hanks was Executive Secretary of the Special Studies Project of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and in that period was Project Coordinator for the study The Performing Arts, Problems and Prospects. Her most recent interest in service is as an enthusiastic member of the National Commission on Critical Choices for Americans. Now, for our purposes today, a critical choice for Nancy Hanks is how the National Endowment disposes of $75 million this year to encourage and assist our cultural resources. Miss Hanks.
Thank you, John. One of the reasons it's appropriate that this stage is this way, I got to thinking, we really haven't had much trouble in the federal government expending monies for the arts. You know, when people first started talking about monies from the federal government for the arts, there was the talk about government control. The worst trouble I ever got in was because of Eugene O'Neill. I was written a letter from an unnamed town. They wanted to know what I thought of changing the name of Main Street to O'Neill. I wrote back, very carefully worded letter, because I don't think the federal government should tell anybody what to do, and I merely said Eugene O'Neill was a famous playwright. Headline, paper, next day, chairman, National Endowment for the Arts, tries to rename Main Street. So here I am on the stage of the set, and that was really a very good lesson for me. I mean, I hadn't done anything wrong. I had just stated a fact. But it was taken a bit out of context. Unfortunately, the grants that we have been making have not been. This morning, I thought I might mention just very briefly a bit about the history of the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Council on the Arts, because many of you may not even know what it is. It is a very small agency of the federal government. $75 million sounds like a lot of money, but it's a very little bit of money when you're thinking in government terms. Also, when we're thinking of individuals, it is only 35 cents per capita expenditure by the federal government in this country. Fortunately for this country, most of the money for support of the arts and cultural activities comes from generous private donors, comes from earned income, comes from corporations, comes from foundations, and increasingly comes from governments. But the money from governments is not to replace private monies, but rather to encourage private monies. And the endowment itself gives money. It operates basically like a private foundation. Much more so than, say, a usual government agency. We have an advisory council of 26 men and women from all over this country. We have 200 advisors in terms of our panels, and these people all make the decisions on the grants. The fields that we cover cover all of the arts. We have programs, modest as they are, for museums, orchestras, opera companies, dance companies, theater. We have an education program, which many of you may know about, the Artists in the Schools program. We have the new program in Expansion Arts, which is basically arts in the neighborhood, literature, public media. One of our newest programs is in film, radio, and television, folk arts, crafts, and I almost forgot, One of our most important is architecture and in environmental arts. This is the only country in the world that has an architecture program with the other arts. And yet, what is architecture? It's an art form of life, and maybe some of our cities would look a little bit better if we had always viewed it as an art and not just as a tool to build inhumane places. Since I'm sharing this occasion with one of America's greatest historians, I thought I might review with you the history of the nation in 5 minutes. Now, you can do that if you limit your remarks to public interest in the arts. You don't have to talk very long. Now, so I can start with Washington. You see, it'd take him 1,000 pages to do this, not me. In one of Washington's first messages to the first Congress, he talked about public interest and the importance of the arts. Nothing much happened for 200 years. Of course, Washington did express public interest in the arts with L'Enfant and the design of this city. He was also an architect himself. Take a look at Mount Vernon and the veranda. That's a very important architectural statement in this country. And then, of course, Jefferson, as you know, well-known lover of the arts, great builder, great architect, and he also talked about the arts. Nothing else happened. Many leaders spoke about them. But you see, I guess, and Dan Borstein will be able to tell you better than I, the priority of the nation was to build a nation, was to push the frontiers forward. Now, that doesn't mean that individual people didn't have an interest in the arts. Think for a minute. The nation was built on the pride, great pride in craftsmanship. There was great singing around the campfires and dancing as the nation pushed westward. And what was the first civic building built after a frontier town really sort of got going? That was the Opera House. But then, let's go very quickly. Nothing much happened, and I've got to go much faster. The cue card just told me. Let's go to, you know, Andrew Jackson ruined Pennsylvania Avenue by putting the Treasury Building. Cal Coolidge said, when asked about the arts, I like them. Roosevelt talked about poverty and was concerned with poverty, so to keep people alive, he kept theater alive through the WPA. He made New York the art capital of the world. Eisenhower tried to get an art bill through. It failed. It was a brilliant bill. I typed it. And then, let's see, John Kennedy, you know, his interest, and President Johnson signed the first cultural bill ever signed by a president for all the arts in all the country in September 1964, establishing the National Council on the Arts. The endowment was established a year later. And the interest in the arts is not a government official deciding we should have more beauty. It's because the people all over this country became and started participating in the arts. And in great part, in my view, in response to some of the problems caused for individuals by American technology. And of course, there's been no more brilliant writer on that subject than Dr. Borstein.
One of the newest symbols of America's abiding interest in her cultural history here in the national capital is the National Museum of History and Technology of the Smithsonian Institution. The director of that museum is Daniel J. Borstein, to which he most certainly brings a broad American heritage and global experience. Touching just a few high spots in a very brilliant career, Professor Borstein was born in Georgia, raised in Oklahoma, earned his undergraduate degree at Harvard, his doctorate at Yale, was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, where he won a coveted double first, 2 degrees with first-class honors, was admitted as a barrister at law in England after study at the Inner Temple in London. For a quarter of a century, he taught at the University of Chicago, which he left to come to the museum. He was the Preston and Sterling Morton Distinguished Service Professor of American History at Chicago, a visiting professor at the University of Rome and Kyoto, University in Japan, the first incumbent of the chair of American history at the Sorbonne in Paris, and the Pitt Professor of American History and Institutions, and fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge University, England, which awarded him its degree of Doctor of Letters. And in his spare time, Professor Boston has written about a dozen books, received the Bancroft and Francis Parkman Prizes respectively for The Americans, The Colonial Experience, and The Americans, The National Experience. Dr. Boston.
People use all sorts of different techniques to intimidate their fellow member of a panel. I'm fortunate that my colleagues have used the technique of overpraise and flattery, but that won't get you anywhere, Nancy. I'm sorry, John. I think that Nancy has started off on has raised an important point which we must remember, and that is the problem of democracy and the problem of the arts. These are two problems that are much intertwined, and looked at in a long historical perspective, just as our nation was developed in order to save government from the aristocracies, we might say that our civilization has also been developed to save the arts from the academies. The respectable people, usually the moneyed classes in the old world, were those who dominated the arts. But technology and the growth of an American standard of living have created peculiar problems for the arts in our time, and I think I can illustrate them by a story about a French scientist, and we all know, of course, how logic-bound and attentive to reason the French people are. This was a French scientist who was investigating the behavior of fleas, and he put a flea on his hand, and he commanded it to jump, and the flea jumped. Then he took this unfortunate flea and removed the two hind legs and put the flea back on his hand, and he commanded it again. He said, jump. The flea did not jump. He then produced a report in which he said that his experiments had been very fruitful, because he discovered that when you remove the hind legs of a flea, it made the flea deaf. And I suggest that this is a parable of our problem today, and especially I would like to talk for a moment about the effect of television on the arts. One of the great purpose of the arts, of course, is to deprovincialize us, to enlarge ourselves and our experience, to help us discover the otherwise. Other times and places, other forms of experience. But I suggest that our recent technology, and especially television, has had a tendency in another direction. And I want briefly to mention two developments. First, what I would call the declining sense of place, the tendency to overwhelm us with the distant rather than with the near. When we watch our television screen, we tend to see a very large proportion of events reported from a great distance, from the nation's capital, from the places where events happen at the center. That is where the reporters and journalists tend to be concentrated. It is where our attention is increasingly focused. The result is that the far seems much closer than the near, and we produce what I would call inverted distance. The meetings such as those we're having here this morning become rarer and rarer. People do not go out and meet one another face to face. This produces what I would call the decline of congregation. The audience becomes a mystery. Instead of being people whom we can see and whose expressions we can share and whose presence we can enjoy, the audience becomes a question of Nielsen ratings, the subject of a very occult science. There's a tendency also, as we rely more and more on the apparatus of television, for news to displace experience. Experience being the sensations which come to us as individuals. And also, when we are concerned about the opinions of our fellow citizens, there's a tendency for public opinion, which is the rendering of statistics, to displace personal opinion, which is a complex of feelings and notions. A second tendency, I refer to the declining sense of place, what might be called hyperopia, the far-sightedness, a tendency for us to see the far things clearer than the near things. A second tendency is what we might call myopia in relation to time, a declining sense of the past, a detachment from history, and a tendency to see recent events as the most vivid. The most recent overwhelms us. The instant present is brought to us on television and before we have had a chance to discover its meaning or before the commentators have learned to pronounce the names of the participants. A consequence of this is bewilderment. We're puzzled as to whether what we're seeing is live, where it is occurring, or when it is occurring. We tend to be confused because we are aware that much of the reporting of news is one of the most prosperous forms of planned obsolescence. A news story must be capable of being qualified, denied, or added to the next day. This leads to the problem of erasure, which dominates much of our reading of the news, the need to discover what we learned yesterday, which we must forget. And it's much harder to forget than it is to remember. It also tends to lead us to a kind of rootlessness, a feeling that we were born yesterday and that we don't need the resources of the more distant past. All this produces problems for us as Americans in a high-technology society, reaching for the poignancy of other times and other places. It produces what I would call attenuation, a thinning out of experience. And even more than that, it produces an ambiguity of experience. When did this happen? Where did it happen? To whom? And for what purpose? Now, it seems to me, as we consider the future of the arts in America, we have to face this problem of the transformation of the very large proportion of the experience of all of our citizens. We have to find new forms of congregation, new ways of encouraging our citizens to come together in one another's physical presence, to enjoy one another while they enjoy the spectacles that they witness. We have to find new ways to revive our sense of the past and our ties to the past. These are the tasks not only of our important agencies supported, as they properly are and increasingly are, like the National Endowments, but it also is most especially a problem for each citizen. Thank you.
All right, now to move to a wider exchange in our town meeting, two distinguished members of the news media will question Ms. Hanks and Dr. Boorstin and be joined very soon, I hope, by our audience here at Kennedy Center. Now, we have in hand questions that have been mailed in by members of our weekly audience, previously informed of the subject matter of future broadcasts, and we, of course, invite all of you who are here to send up written questions if you prefer to do it that way, and they will be, as usual, picked up at the end of your row of seats throughout the meeting. And for those who would prefer to ask their questions personally, orally, two of our microphones are out there with staff members. Now, our first priority is the fruitful use of our town meeting time. So, in our questions, we're interested in questions, not statements, with each question limited to 45 seconds. And when 15 seconds are left, you will see a cue signal from up here on the stage. One final point, the floor microphones are for the general public, please. The news media are splendidly represented here on the panel. To wit, from the National Review, book and art critic Michael Sobran, and from New York Magazine, a cogent and pungent critic of the current scene, Nora Ephron. Miss Ephron, will you start off, please?
Yes, I should say that I've never asked a question in 45 seconds in my life, owing to a problem I have with articulation, but I did want to ask you, Miss Hanks, I don't know what kind of an answer I'm going to get, but I wonder how you managed to raise $75 million with a president whose views on culture came out a couple of weeks ago in the transcript of that tape as a place for Jews and left-wingers. I have no trouble answering the question. You might not like the answer, but I have no trouble with the question because I think it's a wonderful one. I think that and a very appropriate one to ask. President Nixon's actions, not only personally but professionally, in connection with the arts and his enjoyment of them personally, his actions in supporting this very small federal agency, which is an action, a professional action, were totally opposed to a statement that appeared in on the tapes. I mean, here is a man who, one of his daughters very much involved in the arts, the other one likes them very much. He enjoyed music too, was very proud of his piano playing ability. He took an agency that, say, if you want to talk in money terms, was $8 million, and through his strong backing, we were able to increase it last year to some 60-plus into $75 million this year. The comments that he would make to me about the arts and the development of them would be like this. He said, first of all, the important thing is to be certain that the arts get out around the country. At the moment, they, in my view, they are too much located on the coasts. So would your council consider ways to do that? The other thing he said is, I'm particularly interested in our young people. Do you have programs that you could possibly involve our young people in the arts? And at the endowment, as many of you may know, our programs are heavily youth-oriented through the Artisan Schools and Expansion Arts.
Would you like to talk to that, Dr. Borsky?
I'll just say one word, and that is, I'm not qualified to enter into the question which Nora asked, but I would say that Nancy's probably too modest to remark that I think one of the reasons was that the administration of the endowments had been so ably accomplished and with such imagination and energy that I think it would have been a great embarrassment to the president to have had to cut the appropriation.
May I say, Miss Nancy, I think he's paid you back for that introduction now. Mr. Sobrin?
Thank you. Dr. Borston, both you and Miss Hanks have suggested that the government should play a positive role in influencing the arts and American culture. Now, I wonder, it's been widely held, I think it's a pretty prevalent view among people in the arts, that art is in many ways subversive rather than promoting it. It tends to smash traditions. Do you think this is so? And if so, do you still, well, how do you reconcile this with the role you envision for government?
Ms. Hanks?
I think the arts are subversive. They're subversive in attack on boredom, on ugliness, drabness. If we think of architecture as an art, boy, I just hope it's as subversive as it can be to make these cities more beautiful and our environments better. You know, it's only 10 years ago we started talking about, you know, water pollution and air pollution and the natural environment. Well, isn't it wonderful now that people are talking about the man-made environment? Not only the new, but we're working now toward, thank heavens, saving our old buildings and adapting them to the new. And I think this is an important role that the arts have played. I mean, isn't it great, just as the country was bound together by its railroads, as you look back in its history, the most unique architecture in the United States was the railroads. And now we're all rushing around trying to save them. So I think they are subversive. They are subversive also in terms of ideas. I think that is perhaps one of the points that you were talking about. They question ideas. Poets question ideas. Theaters question ideas. O'Neill questioned the family and the relationship between people. There's nothing wrong with questions, I don't think.
But if I may say so, it seems to me you use the word subversive to mean something almost like conservative. After all,
conserving?
Well, to preserve old buildings.
We wouldn't build the buildings that we are now tearing down if the arts, say architecture, were as subversive as they should be. Perhaps some of the audience will think, just close your eyes and think of your own cities and think of some of the lower and middle income housing, for example, that has been built in your cities. And then open your eyes and see some that has been built that is very good and not having to be torn down 10 years after it's put up. That's what I mean. I mean, so I would think of the new as well as preserving the old.
Dr. Boysen?
I might try to meet your question head on, and I'm willing to meet it head on.
You're saying I didn't.
Well, yes, I do. I think there was some... No, I think when you talk about... nobody thinks that beauty is subversive, really.
It's marked.
But, I think I've at least... I will interpret the question in a different way. Perhaps I'm wrong. But anyway, I think that one of the... My notion of the of what democracy is about is that democracy is a kind of a society in which it is possible for more people to be subversive and be allowed to be subversive than any other kind of society. And we draw the line when the subversive attitudes or actions of one person interferes with the fulfillment of another person. And that's a difficult line to draw. But I think that if we look not only at the history of ideas, but at the history of the arts, the most boring arts and those that have been least fulfilled are the most respectable. And that's why I spoke about academies. And I think that there are relatively few great artists or artists whose works have lived who were not at one time or another considered to be revolutionaries. And I think that the problem of our society, and I know this is a problem that the national endowments have faced, and I think they've faced it on the whole quite courageously. It's very difficult when you're using public money to support people whose views do not agree with that of the Congress. But that's one of the intents of Congress, too. And I think that our the glory of our institutions, which will make the arts flourish here and which has made the arts flourish here on the whole, has been our search for the widest spectrum of points of view. Now, there's another point which is touched on by your question, and that is the question of the extent to which government should support the arts, the implication being that government support means government control, and this is a very great danger. There's no question about that. But I think there are ways to meet this, and I think that the British Broadcasting Corporation is a shining example of the possibility of having an agency supported by public funds. The BBC, contrary to public view, to the general view, is not supported by taxation. It's supported by a license fee. But the BBC shows the possibility of, if institutional ingenuity is used, to develop institutions which will use public funds and yet keep the airwaves free. All right, Miss Efron?
Dr. Boysen, you spoke about art and democracy, but I wanted to ask about art and politics, both of you, really. To give one example, many of the orchestras and museums in this country are becoming increasingly dependent on federal subsidies. And these are, at the moment, as I understand it, on a year-to-year basis. A grant is given one at a time for one particular show. And I wondered whether you saw any possibility that any of these institutions would be given long-range commitments of some sort, because it seems to me to be very difficult to exist constantly waiting for the next dole.
First of all, I don't think they view it as a dole.
Well,
they view it really as, in many ways, payment for public service rendered, which I think is very important, and this is their attitude toward it. One of the things that government funds have done very wonderfully is that it, in some ways it's changed the attitude of cultural organizations to make them realize they are really public institutions and need to meet the needs of the public. Now, your question, of course, is a very wonderful one in that it represents very much the concern of the particularly major cultural institutions. We, since January 1970, because the National Council on the Arts was concerned with this question, have had our institutional support for the orchestras, theaters, dance companies, and the others, is for projects of a specific thing, youth concerts, a new production, this and that. But it need not be for new or innovative purposes. In other words, it can be for continuing programs. This was a very important change in January of 1970 that the National Council made. I would emphasize again and again that council has what has made this program work well because of the brilliance of its advice. And the so the major institutions know that they're going to have a continuing program of support for a priority item that they set. So that it's our orchestras, for example, I think the grants are approved now some 18 to 20 months in advance of their need for the monies. So that we're trying to, you know, back up, because they do need to know.
But isn't there some fallout in this, in that granted public service is a function of any institution? But I know that one of my friends that I spoke to this week about this panel, who is a figure in the art world, said that there were many people in the art world who felt that the bicentennial was a boondoggle for museums, that if you could come up with, wait, I'm just quoting what she said.
Okay.
If you could come up with some program about America's 200th birthday, there was money in it. It was a way to hook into it. Now, I don't know whether that in particular is true, but I would like to talk about that general question of coming up with something that...
Well, first of all, please tell your friend that that's not true. The National Endowment for the Arts, through the council many months ago, a year ago, stated that any funding it did in connection with bicentennial projects would be the same as within their regular programs. In other words, there's nothing outside of regular programming, basically, for the bicentennial. That means quality, means community support, interest, and that type of thing. Second point is that we are highly concerned when we receive an application that looks like what we call grantsmanship. Beautifully prepared. Even the figures add up. That's rare. We're a little leery if they do. Because this is the... What?
As an insult to the art.
No, it isn't.
All right. No, just a moment.
If you let me finish.
Just a moment. If you want to ask a question later, please do. Meanwhile, the questions are asked to be answered up here. Let's hear the answers.
I didn't, of course, mean to insult anybody. I don't add very well myself. The point is that we have panels of experts, and they review the applications. The applications are not reviewed because of the way they are typed or printed. Many of them are very simple and asking for money. But if you have experts reviewing the application, they know the organization. We use regional panels for the individual fellowships.
All right, now I think we have a question from the audience, a live question, or rather an oral question. Will you go ahead, please, sir?
Talking about
live and oral. I'm not going to get in trouble, too.
Talking about more towards the professional side of the picture, in the view of the events of this past summer concerning the demise of the National Ballet and escalating production costs, is there any direction that the National Endowment can take to help curtail such unfortunate occurrences?
Well, we hope so. There's certainly no way that we can prevent a demise of any company because really the life of the company depends on the involvement of the community and the people and the corporations and the foundations within that community. The amounts of monies that we have are totally impossible to support a cultural structure. I mean, there's no way that we would have enough money to have saved that National Ballet. I most assuredly hope that the citizens of Washington will come forth and provide money so that we do have a National Ballet and that we do have an opera. And I think that they will, and there are people working very hard. But that is not the federal government's ability or role, in my view.
All right. Do we have another question over here in the right aisle? Right.
My name is Keith Merlin. I'm from Potomac, Maryland. I'd like to ask both panelists, do you believe that it is unfortunate that the performing arts are not available to the general public? For example, ticket prices are slightly high, while in European countries, quality entertainment is available cheaply for the common man. and what solutions do you propose for this problem?
Before you start, may I just note that we have one question, but it isn't really a question from the audience. Is could all speakers move closer to the microphones? It's difficult to hear at times. Thank you.
Well, what you're talking about is more money. There is a great deal more money going into the arts from government as well, much increased money from corporations and from private sources. Our monies now are generating, we estimate, between $3 and $4 of new monies, usually. The ticket prices on the subscription series of the major cultural institutions are very high indeed. Our monies are basically for their outreach programs. The state agencies also, their monies are for outreach. I would urge that we not think solely in terms of the benefits of the arts in Europe in comparison to ours, because we are very good indeed. By that I mean we have as fine cultural institutions as any in the world. We have certainly as great artists. And furthermore, we have this wonderful, what we call pluralism of support, money coming from all sectors. You see, you don't have in this country, despite the financial difficulties, museums as you do in Italy, that are closing. They're not even opening their doors at all. And some of the major cultural institutions, like, for example, La Scala, there is great difficulty. That is because those institutions are almost solely supported by one source, a national or a federal government. So I think we just have to look for more monies from all sources. The picture, incidentally, and this is very important, in terms of long-range funding for the arts, in my view, I think the most exciting increase in development of monies in this country is coming from the state agencies and eventually from the municipal agencies. The increases are very dramatic this year. New York, for example, went from $18 million to $34 million just in that one state alone to enable the arts to get out to people without those big ticket prices. Other states, Pennsylvania just went from $400,000 to $2 million. This cumulative effect will be very important.
Dr. Boston, we have a written question from the audience from John Baldwin of Akron, Ohio. It has reference to our title, New Directions in the Arts. It's a very direct question. It says, what are the new directions in art? Would you like to tackle that one?
Well, I'm a historian and not a prophet. It's hard enough to be a historian. But I might carry on the question that has just been raised, which is not unrelated to the question that this gentleman has asked, the one you've read. In the United States, we have faced the problem and the opportunity to democratize the arts. That means the opportunity to make all kinds of artistic performance available to a much larger proportion of the population. Now, in doing this, we come up against some very strong traditions, and it happens that in the arts, the traditions, especially in the fine arts, the traditions are strong and very respectable and very well supported by lots of money. I think that if we look at the history of the fine arts in Europe, we'll find that symphony, opera, and other of the high forms of music have tended to be supported partly by the government, but also by patrons. And the patronage of aristocrats, wealthy people, members of the aristocracy, that patronage, on the whole, has been very important in determining the direction of certain of the arts, including painting, of course, which was commissioned by wealthy people to decorate their houses. Now, how do we transform this tradition in this country? Well, some of the tendencies that Nancy has suggested would help explain it. The diffusion of our culture into many different cities and towns. We don't have a single cultural capital, despite what New Yorkers and Bostonians think. We don't. And we have many centers of the arts, And this is a very good thing. We have museums, major museums, all over this country, while in many European, in England, for example, the museums are heavily concentrated in London, and in France, they're heavily concentrated in Paris. So that the long-term problem of this country has been how to democratize the arts without vulgarizing them or making them insipid. And that is a problem. And it's a problem that we face when we watch television, where we have a form of art which is directed to the whole public, which aims to provide something to please everybody while offending nobody. And I would think that the great challenge to the arts in this country, which I think is being met in the area of the performing arts, in the area of music and live theater, I think there are wonderfully effervescent movements going on all over the country. But I think the great power which we must direct our attention to, and which our friends in government and everywhere else must think about, is television. If we, even if we do improve the quality of the symphonies and operas and other performances that people can attend or see occasionally, if people continue to see what they now see on television, I'm accepting this program naturally, we are not going to be able to use our technology to ennoble our democracy and make it flourish.
I have a whole set of very splendid arguments that I could counterpose to what Dr. Boorstin has just said, and one day we'll have a 24-hour town meeting, and I'll do it. Now we have another oral question from the aisle on the left. Please, sir.
On the assumption that aesthetic values can begin in rural areas as the farmer sows his seeds, as well as through the enjoyment of the formal arts in the cities, would either or both Ms. Hanks and Dr. Boorstin comment on whether the current trend to a pluralistic society will contribute to the advancement of the arts, and if so, how?
Well, I'll make a brief comment, but Nancy is much better qualified to answer this than I am. My earlier comment on television and on the problem of the erasure of distance, the inversion of distance, so the far thing seems closer, and the overwhelming of us with the immediate moment, all this has an effect on the relationship between the countryside and the city. And one of the great effects of our standard of living in the last several decades has been there's much less difference between the artistic and entertainment and instructional experience of people living in the country and in the city on the whole. Now, I think that several problems arise out of this. One is that if we want to have the flavor of different parts of our country, which is one of the things that's made this country great, the variety, the difference between the New England accent and the Southern accent, the difference between the landscape of California and that of Michigan, these are this kind of variety is something we want to try to fulfill in artistic ways. This becomes increasingly hard to do as everybody tends to get more and more the same form of news and the same form of entertainment. So I think that we have to do it self-consciously. But the problem is that that these expressions of the local arts are best when they're spontaneous. And having seen some of the elaborate preparations this morning to be sure that our program here this morning would be informal, and of course we have succeeded in being informal, but I don't know how informal we would have been without the preparations. But in any case, this is part of the problem. How to make local art spontaneous and keep them spontaneous without controlling them.
All right, I think Nora Ephron wanted to...
No, I just wanted to say something to the question of new directions in the arts. It's not a question, but I did want to toss something out in case anyone wanted to pick it up. I'm not a historian, but it does seem to me there are a couple of trends that we might want to talk about. One that concerns me as someone who writes a great deal about the women's movement is the trend toward, on the one hand, a great deal more literature about women and the female experience, and on the other hand, this kind of onslaught of movies we're getting in some kind of counter-revolution to it, which is about these male bonding relationships in which women are not involved, and neither are emotions. And that seems a kind of interesting trend to me, and I really use the word trend advisedly. The other thing I want to mention, because it seems relevant, is that when you talk about the high cost of tickets, you also are talking about the high cost of producing culture. And one of the effects of this, which has become much worse in recent years, is that what is produced has to be commercial to justify the huge amount of money that's put into it. And this is affecting all fields, not just film, where it's at its most obvious at the moment. The book business is going through a very interesting phase where it's really shifting from hardcover to mass market publication. And there are only, I think, 5 distributors who handle mass market books. This is going to be a very difficult time for someone to write a book that is not... It will be increasingly difficult to write an uncommercial book and make a living as an artist. The magazine business, which I'm in, is now going through a terrible problem, both with the cost of paper and with postal rates. And one of the results of that is that you have some first-rate magazines dying that were subscription magazines, and you see flourishing this bottomless pit of men's magazines, which seem to sell for $1 and $1.50 a month regularly, 5 and 6 million copies. And, you know, these are very serious problems that the government could be playing some role in. I just thought I'd toss that
out. Let me ask a question, Laura. In the context of your final remarks, would we not have to be concerned that if the government tries to play any role, and I deplore the, quote, men's magazines, although the girls have some, too, these days, if the government tried to play any role, would we have to worry about First Amendment accusations?
I don't think that watching out for the postal rates for subscription magazines is playing the kind of role... That's the kind of role I'm interested in. I'm not remotely interested in censorship of these magazines. I just think it should be easier to publish a serious, less commercial magazine. And these magazines have always been tied to subscriptions, and it's becoming impossible to give people a cut rate given the cost of the mail.
This is really a whole subject in itself, and perhaps in one of the later things we can come to clutch with it. We have a question from the right aisle.
Hi, this is directed to Nancy Hanks. I'm currently enrolled at Montgomery College, and I'm a drama major. And it's a 2-year college, and after that, I'm still undecided as to where I'll go. Exactly what can you offer someone in my situation in terms of scholarships, loans, programs, internships?
Well, the young lady's raised a very important question in that there are no scholarships, fellowships, loans, for undergraduate students in the arts. The Office of Education doesn't have them. Most foundations don't have them. The National Endowment for the Arts does not have them, because we simply have not been able, with the limited amounts of monies, to get into the field of professional training, except in the highly professional schools. I believe we have some very modest support, say, to the 11 independent conservatories of music. We're doing some work, but other than that, the field is too broad. There would be of no way that we can be of help. We have very strong fellowship programs, but I might just give an example in terms of professional artists having time and materials to become more creative and develop their creative talent. The requests for fellowships in photography were 6,000. We had funds to make 60 grants. In the visual arts, 2,750 grants. In other words, I think that this is a very difficult and very serious problem in the country, and it's one of money. The people with talent have a great deal of difficulty obtaining monies to advance their education, and then advance their careers, because it is not just going through school that enables you to develop your talent as an artist. You need fellowship support afterwards and apprentice work and that type of thing.
All right, Dr. Boston, I have a question from the audience for you. One of your recent books has been critical of many of the dissenting views of the 1960s. Do you think the apathy and nostalgia is any healthier or more creative in an historical sense?
Well, I'm not sure I understand. I've already, I think, in a way, answered that question by in reply to Mr. Sobern's question as about the relation of the arts to what's subversive. I think that that our kind of society is one which can accommodate both nostalgia and dissent. And I think that that much of the problem, and I think this is one of the criticism of our society as being a society which breeds dissatisfaction is unfounded. All education exists for the purpose of creating dissatisfaction, making people dissatisfied with the state of their knowledge and hoping for something else. And I think that the same thing is true of a society, that advertising, insofar as it produces dissatisfaction, is not necessarily bad. But our task is to produce, and this is very relevant to our subject today, creative dissatisfaction, to have a society in which the dissatisfactions of people can be channeled into those paths where they can do something about it and build something with it and make something with it. So I think that nostalgia is no relief from anything, although it is it's often pleasant to have as a relief. But we need that, and we need the creative dissatisfactions of our society, in which the arts would be very important.
All right, we have several questions which I think you might go to if you will, and they've come in writing from the audience. In substance, doesn't government involvement in the arts lead to artistic totalitarianism? Now, that's a very blunt phrasing of several questions that are put in other words. Ms. Hanks?
Well, I think not, but only if we are wise enough as a nation to carry forward, in Dr. Boorstein's words, to have creative institutional solutions to our problems. And what that means is that no one person should be making a decision about the cultural development of this country. I myself don't think it'll happen for any number of reasons. First of all, to repeat a little, most of the money for the support of this great nation's cultural resources is private, comes from corporations, foundations, and most of it from individuals. About 50%, 70% is from individuals. The governments are coming in very much as junior partners at the federal level, as well as in all 50 states. The decisions on who gets what money is made by experts in the field and not by administrators. And this is what is very important. And we also rotate the administrator, specialist.
Dr. Boorstein, you want to talk to that subject?
Well, Nancy's had much more experience in this field than I've had, but I would agree with everything she said. I would also urge that there is a difference between providing public support for an enterprise and dominating it. I spent many years at the University of Chicago, the University of Chicago was founded by a gift of some $10 million by John D. Rockefeller Sr. After John D. Rockefeller gave that money, he did not intervene in the slightest way in the conduct of that university. And some of the people who wrote there and who were professors were very critical of some of the things he did. But the important thing is to separate the source of gift from the activity of granting it. And that, I think, is what we're doing in our national endowments.
Right. Let me say, if I may, that we are getting some questions here that suggest subject matter which we can consider for future programs, such as amnesty question. And for those of you in our national audience, we hope if you ever come to Washington, you'll come to the Kennedy Center and take part in a national town meeting during the period you are here. Now, we have, another area which both of you may wish to speak to. I'll give you two of the questions which have come up as they have been written. With so much unemployment, how can you justify spending $75 million? And would you favor a WPA-type art program of the sort we had in the 1932s? Ms. Hanks, you want to go to that first?
Was it two questions from the same person?
Well, I don't know. I've got two cards. I've been in a handwriting expert for the last 27 seconds.
Because my judgment
would be, yes, these probably do come from the same person.
The reason I ask is it would be very interesting. The question of unemployment. We also have to have employment for our artists. These wonderful people. And you see, that's why I asked if the question were for the same person, because the WPA programs were for unemployed artists, and yet they created some of the great artwork and the great centers that we've ever had. As to the question as to whether I would favor a WPA program now, I would not. I hope we don't in the nation get into the unemployment situation that we had that caused the creation of the WPA. But if we do, the arts program should be very strong.
All right, Dr. Boston, do you want to put anything in there? You don't have to.
I have nothing to add.
All right, now we have another area in which there seems to be a lot of specific interest in the questions from the audience. I would pose it to both of you. I think, Ms. Hanks, probably you should start it. They all cover the general area. What is being specifically done to encourage and develop art among the blacks and Puerto Ricans and minority groups of the country? Are there any special programs for that?
Yes, we have some special programs. But to me, the exciting work and development is that I hope in time we won't even need special programs. We have a specific one called Expansion Arts. It is not necessarily minority-oriented, but it happens to serve many minority communities. But it is the arts coming from a neighborhood largely in instruction and training for young people. You have five or six groups, for example, in this city. You have many more in New York, and you're beginning to have them all over the country. They often give performances, street theater, music in the streets, the jazz and ethnic programs. It's a very vital thing. In my view, our encouragement at the endowment of the arts that you are talking about is affecting very positively the other arts in the country. You have a tremendous interest, of course, as you know, in jazz and other ethnic music, but you also have in theaters and so forth. Incidentally, I don't know how many agencies of the government do this, but we print our programs in Spanish as well as in English because of the tremendous Spanish-speaking population in the country and their great interest in the arts.
Mike Sobran, you've got a question?
Well, I have certain reservations about the whole business of government in the arts. I wouldn't pass for a National Review person if I didn't. But it seems to me, though, just on the face of it, that there's something dubious about the idea of a government fostering things that are subversive of itself. I mean, any government. I don't say this out of my affection for the Ford regime, for instance, it seems to me that television has been one of the great agencies of homogenizing culture and of increasing the influence of government. And I don't see how government, how from Washington, we can encourage local ties and affections, a sense of the past, and diminish all the things that government just tends naturally in our circumstances to do the opposite of. Do you have any...
Dr. Boston, wouldn't you like to
talk? Yes, I would be glad to try to comment on that interesting question. I would also like to comment on the earlier question which Nancy was talking about. I think segregation is an abomination, whether it be the segregation of people by race, religion, sex, whatever it is. And I consider that While every kind, every person in the United States has his own special needs, that the tendency to segregate artistic programs, intellectual programs, dormitories, drinking fountains, toilets, anything by race, is evil. And I think there is a kind of condescension in saying, well, here's a program, these poor minorities need a special program, and therefore we'll give them a program special for them. No program is good enough for any American unless it's good enough for all Americans. And I think it's very important that we insist on that, because in the current, in the wholesome concern to right the wrongs of the past, a lot of people have gone overboard in reverse discrimination and in that way have created new evils. Now, on the other question, which Mr. Sobern asked on behalf of the National Review, and I understand his feelings in this, and I must say in many respects I certainly share his general distrust of government. And I think it's wholesome that we should all distrust our government. I think whoever our president should be, I think that it's the sign of an effective representative government if we live in a society where we can feel that distrust and yet conduct the affairs in an effective way. But when we come to the question of subversion, I think there is a paradox here which you've hit on. One of the purposes of education, as Jefferson was always insisted, was in the long run the subversion of the existing order. Education, Jefferson said, you remember that every generation should fertilize the tree, the roots of the tree of liberty with a revolution. And there are various kinds of revolutions. Jefferson was also a great champion of the arts. But I think that this is one of the things we have to face, and that's the risk of freedom, is the willingness to have a system of education which will allow people to read Karl Marx and Adolf Hitler and Mao and all the rest of them and yet not be afraid that that will subvert our institutions. And this, so that I think that we have to face this fact. It's not an easy path, it's a threatening path, but that's one we've committed ourselves to.
All right, Ms. Hanks, do you want to go to this issue? Or you?
I'm coming
in. There's a question from the audience, a visitor to Washington, Charles Murray from Edinburgh, Scotland. And the question is general. I think we will address it to you, Ms. Hanks, Mr. Murray's question. Is not the price of mass-producing the arts in order to reach the public one of cheapening those arts?
The Scottish Arts Council is one of the finest in the world. I don't think that any of their work that is being done would, in my view, cheapen the arts in any way. I think that the Scottish program is quite imaginative the last time I saw it and heard about it. Incidentally, the reason I'm very knowledgeable about it is we have had the opportunity of exchanging views with people involved in arts councils around the world as they come to this country and have benefited very much from them. I think the question perhaps is more toward, if you make the arts more available to more people, or you allow, I've sometimes heard that word, allow more people to participate in the arts, are they going to be worse? All I can say is if you have a lot more art, you're going to have quantitatively a lot more bad art. You're also going to have quantitatively a lot more good art. And I see no cheapening and no change in standards except up. Standards are increasing rapidly because if people participate in the arts and enjoy them, then they demand more of the cultural institutions. And also the more of our children who understand music and who can learn to play, the better our orchestras will be. The ones I've got a beautiful portfolio from Salem, Oregon, with youngsters 15 to 16 years old who've studied in the Artisan Schools program for just 1 year. And we might not hang those prints on the walls of the National Gallery tomorrow, but we certainly would hang them in almost any other place because these 15 and 16-year-old youngsters are really doing good work. I think it's the other way around.
Fine. We have a question from the left aisle.
My name is Mark Haber from Alexandria, and my question is this. When Lockheed was failing, the government stepped in with loan guarantees and loans to Lockheed. When the railroads were failing, we developed Amtrak. Now, I maintain that $75 million or 35 cents per capita is a drop in the bucket to the performing and to the arts. And what is needed is uninflationary billions or a great deal, much more money than we are getting now. What lobbying, what politics, how can the uninflationary billions be released for the arts?
By forceful statements by persons like yourself and persons all over the country. That is exactly it. Public opinion polls we have say that more people, a great percentage of American people, would spend $5 per person of public monies for the arts. And as you put it in proper context, we're at 35 cents.
Dr. Burstyn?
I'm interested in the comment because I thought perhaps that the gentleman who asked the question was going to conclude by saying that we shouldn't support Lockheed or Amtrak either. And I think some of us who've recently ridden on Amtrak might wonder. Having been 10 hours late between Chicago and Denver recently. But I think the... I'm not sure I would go so all out for the billions and millions and billions for the arts. I think that we have a problem of using our public resources to encourage and develop the arts, but not to make our arts dependent on the public treasury. One of the great things about the arts and our culture in this country is that our museums, for example, have on the whole been private institutions. The Art Institute of Chicago, the Metropolitan Museum in New York, the Museum in Detroit, and hosts of other museums, for example, have been private enterprises supported by citizens who get the habit of support. The same thing has been true of our universities. So that I think that we do want to give ample support. We want to increase the support to the important enterprises that Nancy and her colleagues are administering, but we don't want to run the risk of making these enterprises dependent on them. Now, just one other question in relation to a comment made earlier on relation to cheapening. I recall there was a young gentleman here a moment ago who was complaining about the high cost of tickets. I think the arts should be cheapened, if by that we mean making them less expensive. But I'm sure Nancy would go with me. But that's a different thing from vulgarizing the arts. Popularizing is not degrading. And this is something that many of our friends in the old world don't realize so well. Even though Scotland has been a source of one of the most widely read and profitable editions of the Bible, the Bible, of course, is an example of a work that has been very popular, but without noticeably having suffered in the course of it. And I think that that we must make a distinction between cheapening the thing, making it available to everybody, and vulgarizing it in the sense of degrading it or making it useless to people.
All right, we have a question from the right aisle coming.
My name is Colleen Heller from Bowie, Maryland. And my question is, what could be really done about the domineering representation of violence on television? The form in which it's represented is really brutal and has nothing to do with art.
All right, the question essentially goes to the matter of violence on television and there's a great disinclination here, but somebody's got to do it. Dr. Burstyn, you started off.
Oh, all right.
You've already spoken to the subject in a degree.
I think one of the things about it is that we have a tendency to attribute evil motives to people who are just making the machine run. And in the case of television, it's boring to look at television and see people just sitting there. Somebody has to be moving, and if somebody's hitting somebody else, it really is much more interesting. So there is something in the medium of television which inevitably encourages movement, and that's one reason why demonstrations are much more popular on television than other more peaceful and less mobile forms of political expression. So I think that this is built into the medium. The question is, I think, and I must say, having recently seen some performances of Macbeth and King Lear, which people think of as classics and not as violence, I think that the problem is not whether there is too much violence on television, but whether the quality of the product is good or not. And I think it would be a dreary, boring world if we eliminated the depiction of violence. This is the task of our dramatists and our novelists, is to make this into a creative form.
All right, we have a question here which perhaps both of you would like to approach. It's addressed to you, Dr. Boston, so you start, if you will. In looking at the other nations of the world, America seems terribly young. Is there any one art that we can call our own?
Well, I assume that questioner was trying to flatter me or us by calling us young. I'm not sure I consider that to be flattery. I think we forget certain things about our country. I don't know how people think up these cutoff points. There is no sharp line between the culture of the old world and the culture of the new. Our literature, our sacred books, and our books of science and philosophy, these come to us from antiquity. So that we're not young, except in some peculiar sense, which I don't quite understand, perhaps in our lust for youth. And I'm not even sure that that's the case, because many of the young people I know would rather not mention their age. But the problem is to realize some of our maturity. We now have the oldest written constitution in the world, and we are in that sense the most, perhaps politically, the most mature nation, as the recent events have shown. And I think that the problem of continuity is one which I have mentioned, and which many of the developments of our technology have made more difficult to solve. Was there another question there? I'm sorry. Was that
no?
That,
that's
you have some very distinct art forms that began here. For example, the modern dance movement in this country, jazz. Blues, a lot of the contemporary American music is very definitely very American. There is an American school of painting, or many schools of painting, that are very different from European or the Eastern. So there are quite a few very distinct American art forms.
The question I think was there a distinctive American art form? And I would think, I would have to say yes to that. And I think that it's the movies. And I think this is an example of a democratized art form. And I think that, as I mentioned before, our task is the democratization of the arts. I think that's the same thing has been true in music. I think that our great achievements in music, in my uninformed opinion, have not been in the area of classical music, but in the form of musical comedy and the popular music, which is heard all over the world.
All right, I'm afraid that uses up all of our time. It doesn't seem to make much difference whether we're in daylight saving or standard. It always goes at about the same speed. So we must close the forum with the hope that you found this a fruitful and interesting use of your morning.